All right, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Redfield, episode 202. Deborah is not here today, so it's just going to be me and the guest. And I think it should be a good one. But in the meantime, guys, we are Value for Value Production. So that means that we do not accept any sort of sponsor money from any companies or brands or anything like that. We're solely funded by myself and whatever small contributions people have made to the show throughout our 202 episodes. So if you want to be among the numbers of the people that have donated, we'd really appreciate it. All our options for donating money are in the show notes. Do it like PayPal or Venmo or Cash App. And if you don't have money right now, no sweat. If you can donate a 5-star review, recommend us to friends and family, get our numbers up, or, you know, maybe give us some technical support or help. Maybe make us a new theme song or something like that. But we'd love to hear from all of you. You can get at us through email, through Twitter, through Instagram. These Instagram messages are tough nowadays. Like, it doesn't come right through. Sometimes you have to accept a request to get a message from people. So if people have sent me messages and I haven't responded quickly, it's through Instagram. It's because of that. Best way to get at us is email, probably. Deborah Gets Redpilled at protonmail.com or pm.me. Link for that's in the show notes too. But yeah, other than that, I don't know. World's going wild right now. Thanksgiving's coming up. It's my favorite holiday of the whole year. Deborah's coming, her husband's coming, and her other daughter is also coming. We're doing it here at the house, and I'm really excited. Get to cook, just hang out. It's going to be sunny. And we've had a really nice November here. It's been a little rainy sometimes, but we've had a couple weeks of real nice weather and actually got to enjoy fall here. It's getting cold. But yeah, everybody's doing good. Animals are happy. Got everybody all cordoned off and separated. And everybody that's supposed to be is getting pregnant. And except for Emily. So give us good vibes there, guys. And but with that, we will take a break here for a second. I'm gonna let my guest in. I'll be right back. All right, guys, we're back and we're here with our guest today is JB Beverly, and he is a guy that I had not heard of, and then I started listening to History Homos, and I heard you on a bunch of their episodes, and you were kind of just I love that show because they get into conspiracy and history, and then when you're on, you can talk pretty competently about punk rock and history and conspiracies and all that stuff and geopolitics, everything. And I heard you mention your email on there. You got back to me, and we set this up. So welcome to the show. How's it going, man?
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in. You know, any day above ground, I'm in the fight. I'm in the ring, so I'm calling a win.
You've been out in nature doing stuff recently or something like that?
Yeah, I did a wilderness retreat not long ago, and then I had to go move a bunch of cattle. I wound up defaulting and becoming a cowboy in my mid-40s after COVID hit because I couldn't be on the road or do what I used to do, so I started training horses and picking up some outfitting work and doing some stuff in that world, which is kind of a breath of fresh air on the one hand and just crazy on the other. To be my age, I mean, I'm working with guys that I, you know, in some instances I could have fathered, you know.
So yeah, it's like, yeah. How's that? How's your body holding up doing all that? I know cowboying is the real deal.
I've cracked 3 ribs, dislocated my bottom right rib. I bruised my right hip to the bone. Snapped my pinky finger damn near off, and I wind up cursing up a storm by the end of the day, typically usually under my breath. It's rarely directed at somebody, but
that pinky finger is like the most commonly broken bone on the body. Yeah,
I didn't
no, you
know
can
that.
see. Yeah, mine's all crooked from that's from I used to work for the Forest Service cutting down a tree. But yeah, what part of the world are you in? Are you allowed to say that?
I'm in the northeastern part of North Carolina right now. I've been there like 12 years. I'm about 2 hours south of Richmond, Virginia, and about 80, 90 miles east of Raleigh.
You like it?
I like where I'm at. It's quiet. I don't want to live in the city. I don't want to be around a lot of people. I like where I'm at because it tends to be pretty quiet and calm. And I'm excuse me. I've got my respect here. Like people leave me alone. I help the state with snake related problems and do reptile conservation. So, my house is pretty safe. Nobody wants to play catch the rattlesnake coming into the snake man's house, so
Yeah,
there's that kind of stuff.
it's funny to see how many old punk rockers that, loved living in the city and getting up to no good back in the old days now just want to live out in the woods and be left alone. That's what I'm doing right
I
now.
got more than my fair share of it. Where are you based out of now?
I am in Northwest Oregon, up at the very, very northwest tip of Oregon, about an hour west of Portland, and it's an hour more west, and I'm at in Astoria at the coast. But I'm like way up. I'm like actually farther north than a lot of parts of Washington. So, yeah, my we lived in San Francisco. I grew up, I lived my whole from my early 20s until my mid 30s in Oakland and San Francisco, and we got to about 2018 and. I looked at my wife, we were living in a one bedroom apartment in San Francisco, and I said, we got to get out of here. She was on board. We ended up getting up to kind of suburban Portland, right over the border from Portland in this little working class suburb. We're able to buy a house, which was something we were never going to be able to do in the Bay Area, where we, any place that we wanted to live, we wouldn't have been able to afford.
Which
And
suburb outside of Portland y'all wind up at?
Milwaukee. So
Okay.
it's pretty much just like an extension of Southeast Portland, and it's
Well, I know that area pretty well. My main tattoo artist is Jason Talby. He used to own Living Art Tattoo in Gresham, so I used to spend a lot of time out in that area.
cool. Is he still around? I'm looking, I haven't
He's
gotten
not
tattooed
in
much.
Oregon anymore, but he's right in I don't know if I should divulge his coordinates, but
Yeah.
he's right over the California line. I mean, he could drive to Portland in no time at all, but he's right over the border.
Right on. Yeah. And then so we,
I can put you in touch with a man if you want some ink, though. He,
Okay,
that'd be cool.
cool. Yeah, so we lived there for, 3 years. Did minimal work to our house and were able to sell it for a whole bunch of money, and then got up here 15 acres to a dilapidated old homestead, and we're slowly
15
just,
acres. Nice.
yeah, almost 16 actually, and we're just fixing up the house now, going to the dump nonstop.
You guys got any chickens or livestock or anything going on out there?
Yeah, I got a whole bunch of chickens. I got 16 sheep, and we've got 6 pigs. So
Right on.
we had 8 pigs. We lost 2 in the past month. So,
To what?
just being they were kind of the runts, they were the ones that weren't supposed to make it anyway. So it sucked. It always sucks losing animals, especially when you're kind of a I grew up in Portland. I was a city kid, so I've got like 40 years of animals or pets, built into me. So I'm still I love all my animals, and it's hard when they go, even if they're
Sure.
livestock that I'm gonna eat anyway,
It's never easy, man. I mean, I've wept over losing like rattlesnakes in my reptile collection over the years, and that's something people don't understand. Where it's like, man, how are you gonna get like emotional over an animal that, if left to its druthers, could take you out in a nanosecond? And it's like, you either understand that or you don't. I mean, I can't sell it to you, I can't explain it to you,
Well, did you always were you from the Southeast originally?
Born in Virginia. I was born in Arlington, and then my dad's whole family is from Wise County out in the southwestmost corner, right where Virginia meets Kentucky, Tennessee, and West Virginia, out in that area in the mountains, the heart of Appalachia. And I'd go back and forth as a kid, and then we moved to South Carolina when I was 8, pushing 8, and then my folks split when I was 10 and moved right outside the DC area because my mom's dad had retired from Secret Service and was in College Park, Maryland. And so wound up in the DC area. That's when I formed my first band and the Bad Habits back when I was 15, and then just kind of yeah. So basically, Virginia, South Carolina, and then Maryland, DC area was where
Well,
I.
do you mind me asking how old are you?
46.
Okay, I'm 44, so you're a couple years older than me. So you would have been in the DC area in the what, mid-90s, something like that.
1987, we moved there, and then
Okay, got it.
I formed my first band in 90, late 92, and then but yeah, it's weird too because you're not close enough in age, you I'm one of those weird people, man. A lot of guys in our generation, especially that are into like roots country or roots music, they kind of like came from punk rock and then later in life discovered Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings and Hank Williams and things like that. I'm kind of the opposite in the sense that I grew up hearing like all that old country stuff and like early rock and roll and rockabilly and then of course by the time my folks split, that was my mom and dad's music, man. Like even the coolest stuff amongst it, Waylon, Hank
Yeah.
Jr., like Merle Haggard, like it was shit my dad listened to. I want to hear it, and I was too young to know any better. And then of course, like within 2, 3, well, I was 12 when I discovered punk. So I had a friend of mine in the neighborhood, an older kid, he was like 15 or 16. He loaned me three records in the same day. And it was like the day that changed my life. It was the Ramones first album, The Clash's first album, and Nevermind the Bollocks. So I got introduced to the Pistols, the Clash, and the Ramones on the same day, and then the Misfits like a week later. And Black Flag right after that, and Dead Kennedys right after that, and then being around the DC area. So this would have been since 88 going into 89, and then when HR from the Bad Brains, when he got out of prison, that whatever when that whatever the hell that was, they had this. Even though they were based out of New York at the time, the Brains were they had a, you know he was coming home. Their families were all still DC area, so they came down, and it's only 3.5 hours, so they came down and did this kind of last minute unannounced show in DC. I don't. Pretty sure it was a DC Space if I remember correctly, but it was like this last minute thing, man. It was a who's who invite only thing, and this older kid comes out. I'm on this ground floor apartment. Knocks on the door, and hey man, HR's out of prison. The Bad Brains are playing, man. $3. Let's go.
Wow.
I didn't know who HR was. I didn't know who the Bad Brains were, man.
Yeah.
I just thought it was cool as hell that some like 16-year-old skateboarder wanted to like sneak out. Wanted me to sneak out go to a show with him. So. But that was like that seeing that band at that time. This is like right when like Reignition was happening and all that stuff for them. So that was like the game changer, man.
It's
And seeing
funny, if you had never didn't know who the Bad Brains were, some 16-year-old skateboarder knocks on your door, says, "We're going to see the Bad Brains."
he knocked
When
on my
you
door. He tapped on my bedroom window
Okay,
discreetly
stuck you
because I'm on the
out.
ground floor. I was sneaking out. There was no way my
Okay.
mother was consenting to me going into the shithole of DC and at some ungodly hour of the night. Yeah, that wouldn't
Yeah,
happen to my
yeah.
mom.
But yeah, just to be an unsuspecting young kid and then to see who the Bad Brains were when they first came out on stage is something you probably wouldn't be expecting, because if
I'll never
anybody
forget that
doesn't
as long as I
know,
live, man. I'll never. I was I
it's a whole
changed my
bunch
life.
of dreadlocked black guys who look like they should be singing roots reggae, and then to hear the speed and hardcore and see the stage presence of HR back in those days would have
Oh, not to
been
mention too, he's
incredible.
fresh out of prison and like all the piss and vinegar in the world in his tank too, man. Like
Yeah,
that was
doing standing back flips and
exactly,
stuff like
man. I
that.
mean, they opened up the show with the big takeover, and
Yeah.
I mean, I'll say this: I could never do what HR as a front man or what those guys did musically, but energetically, like as far as like the I guess the spirit behind it, like that was the moment where I'm like. Whatever my version of that is, like that's what I want. I want that.
Yeah.
Whatever my version of that is, I want that, so.
Yeah, I was unfortunately the only time that I ever saw them was probably about 2015, and it
Feel very
was
bad for you.
very, very,
I don't
very
envy you, sir.
very disappointing. My roommate and I we went sat there for a couple songs. HR seemed like he was in a catatonic state, didn't know the words to the songs, and we just cut and left. So it was a
What's
bummer.
sad is the band, from what I saw, the footage I saw, I didn't see him live at that point, but I saw some video. The band itself sounded fantastic, but HR
Yeah.
was just so flipping just drugged up and sedated it. Like, I mean, it took away from it from what I saw.
Yeah, what I found though is I've seen the Cro-Mags a whole bunch of times, and if you're lucky enough, John Joseph, alumni of this show as well, he will. They'll do like a 5 or 6 song Bad Brain set at the start of the show sometimes, and he does it
I've heard
perfect.
that. I've
Yeah,
heard that.
so that was cool to see that, and
I've never
you
hung
know.
out with John, but I mean, I've seen Cro-Mags a few times, and I mean, both with him and Harley, and it was always a good time.
Yeah,
But
he's cool. My friend is a guitar tech for Rancid, for Lars Fredriksson, and then he also plays he goes on tour with Cro-Mags when they need a guy to fill in on guitar. So he plays with them sometimes, and he's a conspiracy guy too, Casey, and he's come on the show a bunch, and then he got John Joseph to come on the show, and him and John came on, and just it was like, you know, when lockdowns were still going on. So John Joseph was one of the guys that was actually good on the whole deal. One of the old punk rockers that was actually the real deal got pretty much canceled by the hardcore scene because of it.
stayed true to
And
his roots, yeah.
yeah. And,
Yeah.
you know, I just wound him up and let him go off on like a, on a, he's a, you know, just let him do a 60 minute New Yorker rant about how shitty everything was and
It
how
doesn't take
crazy.
much with the New York guys, man. They
Yeah. So,
won't hesitate to tell you what they think is wrong with the world for sure.
yeah, it was a good time, and I'm glad I got to do that. But yeah, those early DC days, it might have been a little bit before your time, but there was a lot of good stuff coming out of there. I mean, most notably would have been Minor Threat, right?
Yeah, I was too young to have ever seen Minor Threat. I did see early Fugazi. I mean, I saw Fugazi at the original 930 Club on F Street for $3, $5. They used to have these, I forget what they were called, but it was some like, I forget if it was Tuesdays or if some midweek show they would do every so often. It was like an otherwise dead night, but because it was Fugazi and because the ticket prices were cheap, I mean, Ian could, you could pack them in, man. And, it was like some of the first, shows in that vein that I saw. I was really not really into the. I mean, yeah, I missed the quote unquote scene days. I mean, by a little bit. I mean, I was too young. I mean, I started going to shows in '88, and had I been, say, 9, 10 years older than I was, I probably would have certainly been out there for those original
Yeah.
days. But just by sheer default being too young, I didn't get to see any of that stuff. And of course, by the time I did start going to shows, like, I heard more about the history of that town and that city and what the significance it played in the evolution of hardcore and punk than I ever got to witness myself. I mean, I was not really into a lot of the bands that were around at the time. Well, more so in the I guess in the hard rock metal side of things. I mean, I became really good friends with, Scott Wine, Rick Wino, and a lot of the Doom guys. I became really good friends with Bobby Liebling from Pentagram. That was more the guys that I wound up hanging out with and getting to know and going to their shows a lot more often. A lot of the bands in DC that were doing at least the hardcore punk thing at the time, it was very like, not so nuanced politically as far as the whole like straight edge thing. And what I mean by that is, I'm kind of a to each their own kind of person, man. I'll give you an example. A lot of cities, you grew up in the Bay Area, man. I know for a fact that there was a pretty hardcore like Nazi skinhead scene back in the day in the Bay Area, right?
Yeah,
And
in the
so.
eight, I was I came around the generation after that, and I was a skinhead for a long time, and we never had to worry about it. You know, I can count on
So,
the on one hand the time that we saw Nazis at shows,
right. So,
and it got handled like super fast.
well, you can
But back.
imagine in DC though, like, I mean, you have anyone that listens to this that was around DC at the time is going to laugh when I say this, but you had like, I don't know if you ever heard of it, but you ever heard the stories of Lefty back in the DC days? Lefty's just
No.
in. Okay, so Lefty was like the DC being a majority black city, right? You had like five, believe it or not, man, you didn't have no thriving like Nazi skinhead scene back then. What you had was Lefty and her, and I say her for a reason. This woman, Lefty and her like four or five friends that would, throw on like Maltese crosses and occasionally Swazis and wear like screwdriver shirts and shit like that. And they would come to these shows, man. And Lefty, the actor Charles S. Dutton, man.
Yeah.
Lefty, if you happen to hear this, I mean this with no disrespect. You were always nice to me when I was a kid, but Lefty was like, imagine Charles S. Dutton, big black, red bone, big black dude. She looked like Charles S. Dutton with tits, man. I don't know how else to put it, but I mean, just and I don't say that again. I'm not being ugly. She was tough as hell. I think, and then of course, rumors persisted that she. I never saw this side of her, but rumors persisted she become lesbian. But imagine this is how backwards DC was, man. The leader of the closest thing to a clique of neo-Nazis you saw was a black woman that ate pussy.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like
Yeah.
that's how hard you had to dig to get any kind of remotely like knucklehead scene going on. I mean, there's plenty of Sharpies and this, that, but what made up for it? The reason I brought up San Francisco and the Bay Area having a noticeable neo-Nazi presence back in the early days was like, you're not going to see that shit in DC, man. It's a majority black city, was multicultural before there was such a term, musically and everything like that. So what you I you know I don't mean to disrespect anybody's lifestyle, but back in my day, man, like the straight edgers were the closest thing to that you saw. And what I mean by that is if you and me were standing out back in an alleyway at a gig, it did make a damn man. It did make a. I'm trying to watch my mouth. I don't. Are you okay with expletives and whatnot?
Yeah, go for it.
Oh, okay. Well, I was gonna say it didn't make a fuck if you were out there. I know I've already been swearing, but I've been trying not to. But like it didn't make a fuck if you and I were sharing a bumper of beer, smoking a joint, or firing up a couple of cigarettes. Wrong place, wrong time. I've seen it happen. A couple of hard pressed, straight edges would walk by if they smelled cigarette smoke or reefer smoke, or if they heard the clang of some glass back in an alley, and you were drinking or getting high on any level. If you were polluting your blood with any toxic substances. You could have, I mean, you had at least gotten spoke to, if not rolled. So it was one of those things where, like, while I didn't have to deal with neo-Nazi gangs, I mean, yeah, me and my friends a couple of times, man, had a knuckle up with some of Ian MacKay's buddies, man. Never him. I mean, he had no sense to not be a part of that shit. But I mean, the groups that we always had to tussle with were the pissed off straight edgers that, frankly, needed to get a fucking buzz and get their dicks wet instead of fucking with 13-year-old kids out back at the 9:30 club, that kind of shit. So,
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah, there was a big there was a big hardcore scene in the Bay Area where I was there, but it wasn't there wasn't that much straight edge going on. Yeah, and then the whole Nazi thing had died down by the 80s, but or by the mid 90s when I started going to shows at Gilman Street is where I first started going to shows. And but yeah, I remember hearing, all those stories about back in the 80s down below Lower Haight on Haight Street, all the way leading up to the up to Haight, they used to call it Skinhead Hill, and it was just lined, and it was every kind, every color you could imagine, and there was like interaction between all of them. I'm sure they fought sometimes, but they would hang out together, the
yeah, but
Nazis
any group of young people are going to
and
butt heads at
anti-racists.
some point.
I heard stories of them being roommates together and stuff like that. But I grew up in I grew I did my teenage years down there, but I grew up in Portland, and it was like the epicenter in the 80s of the white power scene was Portland, Oregon. And like you remember all those like Donahue and Geraldo shows. When remember when Geraldo got his nose broke? That was like skinheads from Portland fighting with each other on the Donahue show.
I didn't know they were Portland guys, but yeah, I
Yeah,
do remember. I remember that chair hitting him in the, smacking him in his
yeah,
big ass
yeah.
head.
Those old, everybody was doing it. Like they did it. Donahue, Geraldo, Sally, Jesse, Raphael did it. I think Jerry Springer had it. Jerry Springer had like midget Klansmen on too. But those are all on YouTube, and they're fun to go back and watch. And then there's ones that are just like they'll have like they would have guys from like Murphy's Law and Agnostic Front like on the panel and stuff like that. And it's fun to see. They're all on YouTube. You can go back and find them. Did you ever being in DC, and I know a lot of those guys like Ian MacKay, and I've heard HR say it. He said he would call them the Georgetown punks. And they were all kids of like diplomats and parents who were like pretty well off, who lived in the Georgetown area. And I've never been to the
Yeah,
southeast.
I would see them a lot. There was a few places. Well, the Bayou was down there, which is like, if it, back by 93 or better, if there wasn't anything happening at the 930 Club when it was moving, like the Bayou was the other spot you could catch a decent punk or metal show or hardcore show, and that was in Georgetown. So you would see those kids a lot at the Bayou, and then there was this spot called the Aqueducts where you could hang out, and kids would take bumpers of beer and this and that and the other, and they yeah, but you could always spot those kids too though, man, because like you'd never see them during the week, like right after school. Like the hardcore street kids and the train riders and the actual transient, like the real squatter punks. I mean, they're out there rain, snow, shine, year round, stinking up the fucking park, and then the Georgetown punk. Now this may have been different before my time, because I know that Georgetown was, I mean, that's where like Rollins and MacKay and them all bonded and whatnot. So I mean, it may have been more, I guess, may have been less of that diplomat Trustafarian scene before my time. But in my time, like, yeah, man, you'd only see those kids out there like end of the school week, Friday, Saturday into Sunday, and by dinner time Sunday night, they were, mom and dad rang the proverbial dinner bell, and mother, you'd see the motherfuckers till the next weekend if there was a show going on, that kind of stuff,
You'd always hear stories about kids in Berkeley, and their mom would drop them off so they could go panhandle.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
You imagine?
So, but I guess more what I was getting at, did you ever get into any figure out that there was anything sus with any of those kids whose parents may have been diplomats and sort of
I mean, I
influencing
never
the
had any
punk
per I
scene in
never
that
had
way
any
or
old
anything?
I never had any altercations with them, or like any, we never rubbed, got any fights or anything with those kids. I mean, they were also, like I said, they weren't around. Like that, you would only see them if a particular show was going on a weekend. Like fuck, what show was it? I think it was DRI played like on a Tuesday or Wednesday night. And like you wouldn't see those kids at gigs like that. Now, if DRI, same, take the same band, put them on a Friday or Saturday, there they were. So I never really had to engage with them. I mean, I didn't, like, anything sus that I saw in DC came after I got out of school and was living, in a shithole part of the city. And, I spent a year off and on working as a bike messenger and doing certain things I'm not going to disclose in public to pay my bills. And, and it was then that it was like you'd meet people and it's like, oh, you work for Ambassador so and so, or you're Congressman so and so's nephew and or niece, or whatever. Then you start seeing shit that, and like, I would know like some of the bike messengers that had been, like, I'm talking the OG guys that had like security clearance and had been on like the more coveted routes, like whomever, for example, I had a buddy of mine who shall remain nameless that would, he had security clearance. He could drop off blueprints and sensitive materials at the Pentagon and the White House.
Wow,
But
and they were
he had,
using bike
he
messengers, huh?
they had to back then. This, yeah,
Wow.
this is 30 years ago, man. They had no,
Yeah.
you could email that shit to somebody just yet, by a few years. But yeah, but you had to get like a go through, rigorous security clearance to get that gig. And guys like that, and again, any DC people are gonna laugh when they hear this shit. Thursday nights at the Lucky Bar and Madam's Organ were the two spots that a lot of the messengers like to hang out and drink, especially Lucky Bar, because they'd have dollar domestics on Thursdays. So all the you'd see nothing but a sea of half broken down fucking 10-speed bikes and shit sitting outside this bar, a bunch of stank ass bike messengers out
Yeah,
there.
BO must have been incredible in that place.
I almost miss it, but because the
Yeah.
times, I mean, believe it or not, the times were that real back then. But anyway, they would, like you would just hear things, man. You bump into somebody and say, man, I mean, I'll give you an example. I'm just gonna throw this out there. It's like, remember in 2016 when there were whispers that Hillary Clinton and her aide, Huma Abedin, Anthony Weiner's old lady, had a secret lesbian affair going on, and then of course the media carried water and ran cover and said, oh, no, man, back, if I had bumped into you back in 1994, 95, I could have told you that Hillary Clinton and Huma Abedin were fucking getting down, man. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was common fucking knowledge. And I got that information via the bike messenger scene. Because, you know, you, that's like, you know, my buddy Merritt used to say, man, you know, you see the world through the rat's eyes in that world. You see
Yeah.
the world through the rat's eyes. when you're seeing the world from under the dumpster, man, when you're, you know, a piece of alley fucking trash and you're out there and, you know, and nobody's, you know, if anything, people are trying to get away from you.
Yeah.
Nobody's inviting you to their fucking parties, their Shangri-Las, you know, you ain't getting no Christmas cards and shit. You know, you're not getting invited, you know. I mean, nobody, you just kind of become this conscientious observer. And if you're paying attention, a conscientious objector. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you're sitting there and you're seeing this shit for what it is. And I've seen, man, the Capitol would break and you get these. I've seen Republicans and Democrats both do this shit, man. They come up Constitution Avenue, Independence Avenue, and you know, they pull working girls right off I'm talking right off the hose stroll, man. Throw them in their limousine and their cabs and their Lincoln Town cars and this, and run them up to the Mayflower or some other hotel, and you know, hey, we're out of session, you know. Hand me my crack pipe and my whiskey and let's, and you know, and bend over, sweetheart. I mean, I'm obviously paraphrasing to some degree, but I'm not being all that hyperbolic. You know, I mean, I mean, you know, you see politicians picking up girls and you know, polyester miniskirts and shit and 3-4 inch stiletto heels walking up the hose stroll. They're not picking them up as good Samaritans taking them home to
Yeah.
grandma. You know
Yeah.
what I'm saying? So however you want to cut it, they're not taking them home to grandma. So it's one of those things where, yeah, man, it just, I spent enough time there to know. Well, I'll say this. I learned that middle America, and I'm going to include every bit of America outside the Beltway, right? Like mainline America could never understand the ins and outs of that city and how fucked up it really is unless you spent a few good years there. I can tell you stories until, you know, until the Chi-coms detonate the fucking grid, and you know what I'm saying, but it's something you have to see for yourself. You know, it really is. It's kind of like, you know, if you know, it's like somebody that lives in Hollywood trying to tell a mainline American what the Hollywood Hills and Malibu is really like on a Friday night at a
Yeah,
party.
or what the
You know,
casting couch is all about, or something like that.
exactly. I mean, you can hear the stories, and you know, most of them are true. You know, but
Yeah, the amount of blackmail operations that it takes to make Washington, D.C. run cohesively probably is incredible, if that makes any sense.
well, no, that's the thing. That's the secret to how nothing gets done.
Yeah.
It's almost like you know how the mob works those endless construction rackets outside of cities and shit. Like there's always, you know, if it ain't the north side of town, that bridge is the south side of town, that fucking bridge, right? Same. That's DC politics, right?
There's
Or
somebody,
it's
yeah,
like I
they're
always
always
thought I
widening the freeway.
was you ever see that film? I mean, you and I are close enough in age. You ever see that movie, The Distinguished Gentleman, with Eddie Murphy when he runs for Congress on a dead guy's name and wins it?
Yeah.
So if you go back and revisit that film, if I were to sum up DC politics as far as how it's been depicted in culture, excuse me, the scene when he gets to DC and he's met with his little, I guess, handler, the guy sits him down and he says, okay, you know, I got to get your position on the issue. I'm paraphrasing. He's like, how do you feel about smoking? Eddie Murphy's like, well, I don't smoke. I don't give a shit one way or the other. The guy's like, that's not what I'm talking about. He goes, you know, are you for it or are you against it? He says, I don't smoke. I don't give a shit. Why? And the guy goes, well, if you're for it, Big Tobacco will put X, Y, and Z amount of money into your campaign. And if you're against it, the medical industry will put X, Y, and Z, and all these anti-smoking, you know, nonprofits will put money into your coffer and this. And he goes, well, who's offering more money? He's like, we're just going to put you down as anti-smoking. Like, that's really how it works, man. You know, that's,
Yeah.
I mean, if I were to sum it up analogously by way of something depicted foolishly, you know, in a silly capacity and within culture, I mean, that's the closest thing to how it really works that I've ever seen. You know, I mean, I it's weird. I wouldn't trade my time there for anything because of like where I was and when I was, but you also couldn't pay me to go back now.
Yeah.
Like, honest to God, if you had $10 billion and you were like, bro, All you gotta do is spend this on your on the most lavish place you can afford inside Washington, D.C. Keep your fucking money, man. I want nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I totally understand that, man. What was the first, were you always kind of a, you sound like you were always kind of a rebellious kid and stuff. What was the first, not maybe conspiracy, but the first like weird stuff you started noticing in life that kind of opened your eyes to that it might not be as it seems?
That's a good question.
You watch Unsolved Mysteries as a kid?
Here and there. I wasn't like glued. I didn't watch it, you know, weekly or whatever, nightly, whatever it was. But you're talking about with Robert Stack back in that era?
Yeah, I loved it.
I would say that Waco was a big wake up for me.
I was obsessed with it when I was, what was that, 94,
Yeah.
93?
Not, yeah, somewhere in there. Like Waco really got me, I guess, caught me off guard because I, from everything I had seen, like, sure, these people were being standoffish and saying, leave us alone, come on our compound and we'll shoot you. Right? But they weren't holding anybody hostage. They weren't breaking any laws, you know, that at least that were ever proven. And yet, much like Ruby Ridge, it was like the government found their excuse and, you know, which I found out about that posthumously, but you know, it's one of those things where, you know, Waco was a big wake up, man, and some of the stuff that was happening around then too, man. McVeigh was a big thing, and you know, Kaczynski was a big thing, like, you know, and just this idea of, you know, especially like with the whole like when the Unabomber thing happened, where it's like, you know, you hear, okay, this guy's this rogue madman living in a fucking, you know, a polar, was it a Kodiak bear hunting cabin in Alaska or some shit, you know what I mean? And then you read what he wrote, and I would argue that I thought it was intense back then. It's become largely prophetic now. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, I mean, you could put that shit in the Book of Revelation, man. It fit right in, you know.
Nostra Kaczynski, you know?
Yeah, no shit. So anyway, you know, just that, again, that era, like I feel bad for young people these days, because I mean, you again, you and I are close enough in age, which makes this conversation easier to have. But it's like, you know, when you've got Ted Kaczynski, Tim McVeigh, Waco, and like Ruby Ridge all happen in the span of X amount of years. Throw Heaven's Gate in there too, and all, you know, like all that whole era
Yeah,
of shit.
90s were wild, man.
Yeah,
I
man, it was wide
love.
the fuck open, man. And then so I'm sitting there going, like, you know, I knew that this, I guess that's where not growing up in that plush side of tracks with everything handed to me, like some people I knew, you know, I having to live in a neighborhood where I had to like learn how to keep my fucking backpack and my lunch money from getting took, you know, and being having to be able to take care of myself. Like my folks split when I was 10, like I was telling you, man. My dad went in the house on a day-to-day level after that, and you know, I still saw him, but I mean, he didn't live with us, and so I mean, I'm 10 years old, I'm the man of the house, ready to go to war for my mom and my sister. So it's one of those things where, like, had I, but yet I knew kids that lived on the other side of the tracks that, you know, Johnny turned 16 and we bought him a souped up, you know, brand new Mitsubishi Eclipse off the showroom floor with, you know, the low pro tire package and the glass pack. And this kid's, you know, sophomore in high school, take his ass to school and then, you know, a $55,000 car. I mean, I never looked down at those kids, and oftentimes they weren't particularly mean or unpleasant. If anything, like, I liked getting invited to their fucking parties because
Yeah, for
there was
sure.
good shit to eat and drink and smoke over there, man.
And
But at the same,
chicks too.
yeah, no, yeah, the rich girls were my favorite. But my point being though that, like, from a life experience standpoint, from like, can you imagine though coming up in that world where you think it's fucking Donna Reed and Leave It to Beaver, right? Like, you know, oh, the police are here to get your cat out of the tree, and little Bobby and little Susie. And when you think it's this fucking, you think the world is Mayberry on like steroid fucking income, you know, mom and dad, you know, keep in mind too, like where I live, man. I mean, all right, give me an example, man. If you look at the northern part of Montgomery County in Maryland, right? So like where I was at was where Rockville met the west side of Bethesda It was where the working class neighborhood met the richer part of town. These days it's all wealthy. Back then it was a bit of a hodgepodge. You had your working class element, you had your trustafarians, right? But you follow the county going, excuse me, going west, northwest, you go into Potomac. Well, Potomac is like where fucking Patrick Ewing has a mansion, Bill Marriott's mansion, Mike Tyson bought a fucking place out in this neighborhood, Avenel, out in Potomac, Maryland, man. Like it was hotel sized mansions, 8-car garage. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, can you imagine growing up there? And like, imagine your worldview when that's your neighborhood, when you know nothing but money and security, and mom's a plastic surgeon and dad's a fucking patent attorney or whatever the fuck, right? And then you get like, I mean, I don't even know how red-pilled you could get living in La La Land, but I mean, all of a sudden, imagine their take on, wait a minute, what's this shit in Waco? What's this shit in Ruby Ridge? Timothy who? McVeigh who? Kaczynski, Unabomber, who talking about data and technology and the corruption of X, Y, and Z? I mean, it was hard enough for me to go, whoa, there's a big bad world out there. I can't imagine kids that came up that well sheltered and that. And again, I'm not saying this to disparage. I mean, no one has to be born in any fucking environment. I mean, I'm not making a character judgment on these kids, but again, many of them were nice. But I can't imagine like sitting there and growing up, think, where just everything, you go from completely overindulged and living in like the epitome of the lap of luxury. That shock had to, I mean, it's no wonder a lot of them kids wound up, fucked up on pills and dope and career alcoholics despite having medical degrees and shit like that.
I've been sober off alcohol, from 12-step stuff for like 11 years. I got
Gradually.
sober in Marin County, California, which is the county on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge. And it's one of the wealthiest, I don't think it's got anything on those Virginia counties, right outside of DC that are supposedly like the most wealthy ones around. But it's a very, very wealthy area. It's where my wife's
It does
from.
right. Well, I'll say I can't compare, the East Bay or that area to it. But I will tell you this, remember when Aaron Spelling made that 90210 show back in the day? That was supposedly set at West Beverly High School, right? In Beverly Hills. And they sent a research team down to that northwestern part of Montgomery County to Churchill High School and Wooten High School. And I didn't go to school there, but I had heard these rumors that before, right before that show came out, that there were these big TV and movie people that were out there because it was such an East Coast mirror of Beverly Hills as far as affluence and average income and the structure of the fucking school. I mean, the school looked like a gigantic department store or shopping mall. It didn't look like a fucking high school. Like my high school looked like a fucking jail.
Yeah, me
You
too, man.
know, and they got there. Their high schools looked like a fucking, the fucking mansion in Eyes Wide Shut or some shit, man, by comparison.
I went to high school up in the Napa Valley in Northern California, like wine country, and it was a real, I don't know what it's like anymore. My parents don't live there and I don't really have any connection to it, but it was I went to high school with some of the richest kids in California, and then I went to high school with the working class white kids whose dads worked in the cellar at those wineries, and then I went to high school with the Mexican kids whose parents picked grapes, so
Yeah.
it was like the whole thing. And I we're right in the upper part of the middle. That's where I
I got to
grew up,
ask you something, if you don't mind. So between the Bay Area and I know you're a little bit younger, but between the Bay Area and that, and then like California in general, now I don't want to out you if this is a personal thing, but I thought I saw, do you have an Orthodox Christian icon in your email, or was it?
Yeah, I'm ortho bro now.
Well,
So
dig this, man. So you friends with Justin Marlar by chance?
I know of him. I've messaged him a few times, never got back to me.
Justin and I are friends. If you want to
Oh,
put together,
Justin Marlar. Yeah, from High on Fire.
well, from from Sleep originally, yeah. Yeah, I was gonna say if I can put you in touch with him, or I can at least vouch for you if you want to get him on the show. I can't speak for him, but he's a good guy. We've become friends
Yeah, I love
recently.
he's been on my friend Buck's show a bunch of times, or at least one time. So
He's a good guy.
yeah, he lived at the monastery in Platina, California, where Father Seraphim Rose is from,
He
and I
sent
got
me a
to
great picture of you know who came out to visit him when he was out there? Ian
Ian
MacKay.
MacKay. I
He
think Ian
backpacked out
MacKay, I
there.
think he went to visit him when he was actually at a monastery in Alaska, in
You might
Kodiak
be right.
Island.
You might be right. You might be right.
I got to go on a
I just know he forwarded me a picture and he goes, "Hey man," he goes, "You'll know who this is in this photograph." He sent me a picture of him and he.
Yeah, he went on if you ever want to listen to a great interview with him, he did he went on my friend Buck Johnson's show called Counterflow and did a really good explanation. He's from Chico, California. That's where I went to college there.
Yeah, but
So
he
I'm
knows all those guys. Like he was out there at Gilman back in the day. I mean, he
Yeah,
knows
he
all those old Bay Area guys.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a really cool story. I think he's in Austin now. And yeah, he wrote this book called Youth of the Apocalypse, and you can't get it anymore. You used to be able to find a copy every once in a while for like $250, but they're all gone. I think he's supposed to release a new edition sometime soon. I'm really looking forward to it.
You
But
read Death to the World ever?
yeah, I have like everyone. So how about you, man?
Bet you didn't think I was going to ask you about that shit,
No,
did you?
man. Yeah. Yeah, so you know a little bit at least, right? What did you show me? I can't see it.
I'll show you later.
Okay.
It'll stay an
Cool.
inside joke.
Got it. But yeah, so yeah, all that 90s stuff. The 90s was a wild decade, and I was not paying attention to anything. I was I started drinking at in 15, and continued to do it problematically for 17 years, and didn't worry about anything except for the getting through the week till Friday night, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember when Waco happened, I was in 7th or 8th grade, and I was really following it every day on the news. I was just really interested in it. I was in the Pacific Northwest, and for somehow Ruby Ridge had I it didn't register with me. I didn't know about it
I missed that originally too. I caught it a
until
couple years
later.
back. Yeah.
I know a ton about it now. And then I can remember I was a freshman in high school, and I remember my mom driving me home from baseball practice, telling me that there had been some big explosion in Oklahoma City. And I didn't wake up to that until a little later. I saw I've actually got Richard Booth coming on the show next week. And he's a great OKC researcher. He's been on History Homos. And I'm reading this book called Aberration in the Heartland of the Real. Have you ever heard of that one?
I'm not familiar, no.
It's like a 550-page book by that this woman wrote as like her doctorate thesis. And it's good, man. It gets she's super noited and gets into all this wild stuff. So I'm a slow reader, so for me to get through a 500-page book takes a little while. But
You gotta stay heavily inspired, yeah.
yeah, it's hard because like I live on the homestead. I work all day on the homestead, make dinner. My wife comes home. We'll watch like one episode of Sopranos or something. Like we're getting through Sopranos again right now, and then I'll go home and I'll try to read 10 pages a night before I fall asleep. So, but I got a stack of books I got to get into, and yeah, all that 90s PatCon stuff, all the black helicopter stuff. I love all that. The 90s is my favorite era of all that. But
There was no shortage of good art back then, man. I mean, I think the turning of the millennium put the kind of was the first nail in the coffin, and then there's just been subsequent, you know.
yeah, the 90s were kind of like the last real decade.
I mean, arguably though, half of that was bullshit too. I mean, you know, it's funny because it's like you're never. You always hear how cool it was before you. I remember first when I first started going to shows in DC, it was always like, well, you know, you missed like. The pre-New York Bad Brains, you missed, you know, Minor Threat, you missed Dag Nasty, you missed, you know, like all the OG bands, man. And then But then, like, for example, was it 88 going into 89? I saw the Ramones. We were in Virginia, saw the Ramones, and Didi was still in the band, but he got fired like at the end of that tour, right?
Yeah.
But fast forward, it's like 2003. That's all I want to see the Ramones a bunch of times, but of course it was always with CJ after that.
Yeah.
And like in 03, I'm on the fucking I'm on the damn subway train in DC, and this I had a fucking Ramones t-shirt on. And these younger kids, they're like, I'm fuck 2003. I'm what, 26? These kids are like seniors in high school if they hadn't dropped out,
Yeah.
Dude's all like, it's like, man, that's an old Ramones shirt. So like, when was your first Ramones show? I told him. I said, yeah, man, my first Ramones show is like, it was like a couple of weeks before Didi got fired. He's like, fuck, man, you got to see the Ramones with Didi, right?
Yeah.
And fast forward, man, I'm my friend's kid the other week. Ramones came on this playlist, and I started talking about how many times I saw the Ramones, and he's sitting there going like, fuck, you got to see the Ramones, period. So
Yeah.
it's like, you go from like, hey kid, you missed all the good shit, to all of a sudden you're the old guy, and then the kids coming up under you are going like, man, you're lucky as fuck to have seen what you've seen, So it's
Yeah.
funny how that works,
Yeah, I got to see them. It's weird because the Ramones were kind of, I was like a prepubescent metalhead, and then 94, so I started getting into punk rock,
Yeah, and they broke up 96, and they weren't touring the West Coast that much, so you wouldn't have seen them.
Yeah,
Although their
I
last
got,
show was in Hollywood, you could have caught the
yeah,
last.
I had that box set with those videos on it. We used to watch it in the garage that we drank in high school. But the Ramones were for some reason always in my life. Even I didn't even know they were a punk rock band. I remember, having their tapes when I was a little kid, and I love, they're still my, top five bands of all time for me, and I got to see them one time at Lollapalooza. Never at a real show, but it was still pretty cool to get to see them. I had tickets to go see them. I think the next summer it would have been on that final tour of theirs, and I had a football game that night, and I didn't get to go, so it was kind
Yeah.
of a bummer. But yeah, if I could, if you could go back and do it, who would you see that you never got to see? One band.
If I can pick one band that I never got to see that's fuck.
I used to say The Clash. I don't know if I feel that way anymore,
I
but
would, fuck, man, for the longest time, that would have been my go-to answer too, but I would.
did you ever see Mescaleros? No.
All right, maybe 1975 original lineup, Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. I would have liked to have seen that. Like right outside the New York Dolls. I would love
Yeah.
to have seen Thunders and the Heartbreakers in the early days.
Yeah.
Clash was up there, the original Pistols, the Damned. I mean, any of that shit, man. I mean, fuck, I'd cut my fucking left nut off to go see any of them fucking bands back then, like 75, 77. I mean, there's bands that most people haven't even heard of that I fell in love with, when I was eating up at anything punk rock. I mean, you're listening to the Saints
Yeah, I
from
love Saints.
Australia?
All that
Yeah, I
Australian
mean,
stuff, Radio
fuck
Birdman, and
yeah,
all
dude,
that Australian
exactly.
stuff
Like,
I love.
I would have crushed to seen the Saints back in 77, 78, man. Like, what a fucking band. But then
Saints
again,
did
like,
Saints did Lipstick on Your Collar, right? Lipstick on Your Collar. Yeah.
yeah, but then there's like, I don't know. If I had to pick one, though, probably Thunders, man, and the Heartbreakers, or the Dead Boys, like, or the Clash, maybe a three-way tie. I don't know.
Yeah.
Then again, like, I mean, I had friends of mine that I remember. I used to like, man, I wish I'd seen the Misfits, and like, everyone I knew that saw them was like, you weren't missing much live, back then. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I
A
always
lot of their
remember.
shows just ended in fighting and them getting in trouble and getting like chased out of the venue.
Pretty much, but so yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. There's plenty of stuff I would have liked to have seen. I mean, then again, there's bands even outside of that that I wish I had seen that I refused to see for like I guess, political reasons at the time. And I don't mean political in the geopolitical sense. I mean music politics. Like, I could have gone and seen the Grateful Dead a bunch of times before when it was still the Grateful Dead. I never went. I don't want to hang out with a bunch of fucking hippies. You know what I mean? So but in hindsight, like, not I don't own a Grateful Dead record to this day, but just to say I saw them, like, you know what I mean? Looking back, it's like I would have liked to have at least gone, and at least that way, if I left unimpressed, I could say it was validated by a shitty live show and a shitty fan base, instead of just me, mirroring what my friends were saying and being like, fuck those hippies, you know? So I don't know. There's certain bands. I mean, then again, though, I got to see some bands that, you know, I mean, like, I became friendly with Lemmy from Motorhead last few years of his life. And having seen Motorhead was like, I wouldn't trade seeing Motorhead ever. And I saw Motorhead a few times, you know. I mean, fuck, man. I mean, when I was in the Little White Pills, my last like hardcore punk band, we played part of what I like, the best lineup we were ever a part of was at Jack's in Northern Virginia. It was me and the Little White Pills. Little White Pills opening up for Casey Royer and D.I., the Dickies and Dwayne Peters and the Huns. It was like an $8 show. All those bands on the bill. It was fucking great, you know.
Dickies were always a lot of fun to go see live. They're a great band. They still hold up over time for me.
Oh, fuck yeah. Well, they were kind of like the West Coast answer to the Ramones in a way.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
In a real way.
Yeah.
Except they had guitar solos.
Yeah. So a couple years ago, I came across a documentary film called Last Days Here. And it's about this guy, Bobby Liebling. Is that how you say his last name?
Yep.
And he was the lead singer of a band called Pentagram. And they started in what, the mid 70s, something like that.
They formed in 69, cut their first shit in 71. They were right there neck and neck with Black Sabbath and their origin. Yeah.
A little heavier though, right?
Depends on who you ask, but you
yeah.
know.
And
I mean, the way I heard it described back in the day was that, you know, Sabbath were, you know, they were indicative of their culture and their time. They were, you know, Birmingham post-war, you know, a bunch of hash smoking, this is and that's. And Pentagram was, I think, referred to as like America's street, quote unquote, street answer to Black Sabbath was the way I heard it described back in the day, which I think that's fair. But I mean, the thing too, it's like, you seen that documentary, American Hardcore?
Yeah.
Like the, one of the things that Mackay says in there that is so fucking true, you know, you can look at punk rock, hardcore, jazz, metal, blues, you name it. Like, there's always been this just clusterfuck of talent around the DC area. And to paraphrase what Ian said in that film, it's like, you know, that city is like, you know, it's so, it's more, again, it goes back to what I said to you before. It's so powerful that, like, if you don't know how it functions, you wouldn't understand it. I'll give you an example. My friend Jeff, his father was a plumber, which, you know, you associate a plumber as, you know, a well-paying but blue-collar ass crack showing job, right?
Yep.
Well, Jeff's dad, yeah, he's a plumber, but he was he didn't go door-to-door plumb residences. He was the plumber down at the CIA fucking headquarters building. He was the CIA's plumber.
Quantico.
Right, exactly. So my mom, you know, worked for Marriott corporate headquarters. She worked for the president of the company at the time who answered to Bill Marriott. Now, granted, she had an entry-level administrative job, but one of the most powerful multinational hotelier corporations in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the understanding being, I mean, again, Ian touches on this. I'm not quoting him directly when I say this, but it's like everything there is tied to the government, the most powerful government in the world, the headquarters for all kinds of uber powerful multinational corporations, or these like mega wealthy institutions of higher learning. Every last bit of it is tied to one of the three. So it's like, and here's what Ian did say, where it's like, you know, you, if you don't, as a kid, you know, if you don't find something, unless you're part of that or you want to be part of that, like, if you don't, you better find something to hold the fuck on to, man, and hold on tight. And that's why there's so much, no matter what genre, there's so much good music, and so, like, the arts have always flourished in the area because, you know, it's a madhouse outside of that. Like, you have to find, I mean, I know for myself, I'm fuck, man. If I hadn't like done what I, if I hadn't taken the music like I did, I'd be dead. I'd be absolutely fucking. I'd be gone, long gone,
Yeah.
or I'd be doing life in prison. One of the two, hands
Yeah.
down. You know, and so, but anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off, but like you were about to say
No
something about
worries.
Bobby, but like, but yeah, like the, there's just this arsenal of talent back then, in those days.
Yeah. I just wanted to get into kind of the history of Pentagram, your relationship with Bobby and what you can tell us about that.
I met Bobby. I was living in a music group house. My buddy Dave Sherman, who played in Spirit Caravan and Earthride, God rest his soul. Dave died this past year. It broke my heart. But Sherman and I were roommates, and he had known Bobby for a long time. And it was Sherman's birthday, and I'm doing my thing in my room, and he's knocking on my door. He's like, dude, you want to meet Bobby? You got to remember too, man, that Liebling was like this enigmatic guy. Like he was like, you know, it's like the fucking man with no name, or you know, it's kind of like, you know, you'd see him around kind of coming and going, but he never really hung out anywhere. It was almost like, you know, the running joke in Orange County, you know, there's been a Mike Ness spotting, right? You know, that kind of shit. Like, you know, Bobby Liebling spotting, you know, like, you know, he dipped out of some club or something, but he, I had seen the guy around, and he had this like kind of Vlad the Impaler thing going on, the long hair, and you know, and I knew he had this history of at the time, you know, horrid drug abuse. And again, he was just sort of this, his reputation certainly preceded him. And
Did you know about Pentagram, or you just heard that that guy used to
no,
sing in a band?
I absolutely knew Pentagram. Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
I just had never crossed paths with him personally. And then
Well,
Sherman.
what was the deal with them? They had just kind of gotten derailed because of hard partying and drug use and all that stuff, and
Well,
never
the
really.
original band had been derailed since before you and I were born, man. The original band imploded in 75. And Bobby resurrected it. You know, there was one version in the early 80s when, you know, he brought Victor Griffin in and Joe Hasselvander. And then he did a different version in the early 90s. And then he and Hasselvander did the entire Sub Basement record together. And I mean, it was basically whoever Bobby could, like, convince that he was okay to perform and record, and whoever felt like doing a record with him, that's who did a record with him. You know, it's kind of like the you know, I don't know, but yeah, the band never, and the problem too is, I mean, they never toured. I mean, he's done more touring since things were resurrected in that film than he ever did in their prime in the 70s. But yeah, man, it was like, again, it was like Pentagram was one of those bands where the legacy was there, the music was there, but you know, there were these random Bobby sightings. Nobody ever, you know, but I don't know. But Sherman took me to his house, man, and this is a cool thing. If any of your listeners like Bobby or like this like his story, I knew Bobby and I were gonna be friends for life. I mean, I've got to show him how, what's wrong arm? I can show him how album cover tattooed on my forearm, you know, to this day. There's Bob's face, you know, with his hands out, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I knew Bobby and I were going to be family, man. And that night, because I go over there with Sherman, and of course Bobby's, you know, Count Crackula at the time, and
He's smoking
you know,
crack.
right in front of us, man. And
Was he like a he was a heroin guy too?
well, by the time I met him, he was not mainlining dope anymore, but he was taking some ungodly, it was 110, 120 milligram dose of methadone every fucking morning. And the motherfucker ain't but 5'6", 5'7", 100 pounds dipped in goddamn molasses. I mean, I don't know how the fuck he lived through that shit, but I've seen him do it, man. He'd take his methadone, he'd come home, he'd eat something. It'd be the one time a day he'd eat after his methadone treatment. He'd take 4 or 5 Xanax, and by Xanax, I mean the big boys, the bars, right? Take 4 or 5
Yeah.
Xanax, eat a handful of Klonopin, pass the fuck out for 3 or 4 hours, wake up, call the fucking crack man, and get at least a goddamn teener or better, a fucking hard crack, and sit there and smoke that shit until the fucking cab picked him up to take him to the methadone clinic at 5 o'clock the next morning.
Wow.
Every fucking day. I call, you remember the Bionic Man? Remember
Yeah.
the Bionic Man, the show? And the motherfucker would run and go, shh.
Yeah.
I used to call Bobby the Bionic Junkie. I said he'd be like, shh,
Yeah.
motherfucker. I don't. His heart must have been made out of goddamn titanium. Like, who the fuck survives that? Anyway, but he's sitting there with me and Sherman, man. He's fucking, you know, fucking Count Crackula. And we get up to leave. And this is back when I was stupid and I carried my billfold in my back pocket. And I didn't realize I dropped my money clip, man. And I'm outside about to get in Dave's car. And fucking here comes Bobby. He's like, JP. It's like, you dropped your money, man. And here's this crackhead. Like, he could easily pocket in my billfold. I wouldn't know where the fuck I dropped it.
Yeah.
But he comes running outside. He's like, you dropped your money, man. And he was so used to being accused of thieving. I'll never forget this. It might have made me tear up. He's like, hey, man, you can count it. I promise you it's all there. And I could see in his eyes that, like, he was proud of himself for having done the right thing. We had struck a chord, man. And he wasn't going to rip me off. And that's, if you watch the film, I said it on camera. I said, the people's like, why the fuck you put up with this shit, man? Driving him to and from the hospital and this. And I said, hey, man, that motherfucker, sure, he sold his soul to the devil. He's fighting like hell to steal it back, man. I can't. What would that say about me if I turn my back on a man who's trying that hard to be a good person, going up against that lifestyle for that many fucking years?
Yeah.
That's more of an indictment of me than anything that guy ever could have done, if that makes any sense to you and whoever's listening. But I mean, that's how I felt about it at the time, and I'll stand by it, man. But yeah, that night he's like, man, your money's all here. I said, he's like, you can count it. I said, I don't have to, man. I said, thanks for doing the right thing. I put my money in my pocket, and he's been one of my best friends ever since then. I got him tattooed on my fucking arm, and if he called me right now, I'd hang up this fucking call and go handle his business if he needed me. That's how much I love him,
Will you tell the story about him calling you to go get ice cream?
Sure. I would see. I had been staying with him, man. I was helping him, trying to help him get off the fucking drugs because he wanted to move to Philly. This is right when Pellet and them were trying to get him to put the band back together and put some new music out. So this is going to be like 2006 going into 07, and it's hard to think. It's been a decade and a half since this shit happened, but and then some. But the band Blue Cheer. So Paul Whaley, the drummer from Blue Cheer, God rest his soul. Paul Whaley had come to town, and I had met Paul, but I had gone home to tend to some business, and fucking Bobby calls him. He's like, JB, can you come over here and pick me and Paul up? We gotta go get some ice cream. I'm like, mind you, he don't live down the road from me, dude. It's like 15, 20 fucking minutes. I was like, Bobby, wait, what? He's like, you want to meet Paul Whaley? Like, he changed his tune up immediately. He's like, you want to meet Paul? I was like, well, I'd love to meet Paul, but where do you want to go? He's like, oh, he's like, can I get some ice cream or a Snickers bar or something? I was like, then I realized, well, these motherfuckers, Paul must have fucking, because Paul was living in Germany at the time. Paul's American, but he's living in Germany at the time. He had to have put some fucking dope in a rubber or something and gotten it over here. He's staying with Bobby. His guts hit the magic number in the commode, and out came the dope. And they were dope sick as all fuck, and needed some sugar, right? So I don't remember what holiday it was, man. It might have been Thanksgiving. It was some holiday where shit wasn't closed, but it was from President's Day or something. I don't know, man. Like, there wasn't a fucking thing open, man. I'm in this turquoise fucking Jeep, man, four door Jeep, my truck. I'm driving down the road. I got Liebling in the behind me and behind the driver's seat, Whaley in the, behind the passenger seat, nobody in the passenger seat, and those two in fucking unison are out the windows, heave hurling their guts out, driving through fucking DC at 2 o'clock in the morning, trying to find a goddamn Häagen-Dazs store or fucking 7-Eleven or some shit where they can get some fucking a pint of fucking ice cream and cure their fucking dope sickness. But yeah, that's me taking Bobby and Paul Whaley to get fucking get yeah 2 o'clock in the midnight, one, two, whatever the fuck, some witching hour in the morning, driving those fuckers through DC while they painted the side of my truck respectively in their vomit, trying to find something sweet to eat because they're all fucked up on their little dope binge. But yeah, true story.
How's he doing these days?
Seems fine. I haven't physically seen him in a few good years, man, since before COVID, but I talked to him. I mean, we spoke last month for a good while, just caught up for a bit. He seems well. I mean, he didn't strike me as fucked up, and band's been getting some bookings here and there. So I mean, he's a tough old motherfucker, man. Yeah, that guy's Son of a bitch is my mom's age, bro. He's in a spring chicken. He's in his 70s, and it's funny, all them years he fucking treated his body like hell. He finally gets off dope, and then the doctor's all of a sudden like, Bobby, you gotta watch your cholesterol, you gotta watch your blood pressure. You're gaining too much weight, you're eating too much ice cream and this and whatever the fuck. And it's funny when he didn't give a shit and he was like ready to go fucking face death at any moment, he never had to worry about that stuff. And then the minute he gets sober and has a kid and like is trying to hold his shit together and actually spend some time with his son, all of a sudden the doctors are like, hey man, you're gonna die, watch out. Funny.
It's like all that stuff. It's like when people smoke forever and then the doctor's like, well, I'm not going to tell you not to smoke because if you do, you're gonna die, you know. Like,
Yeah,
it's one of
it's
those
true.
ones.
It is true.
Can you tell us about so you were, I heard on History of Homos, you mentioned that you were a member of the Murder Junkies, and that I was like, what? That's I
What?
didn't know that. And
What?
how'd that come about?
Well, I was the one. I knew the songs, and I was dumb enough to take the job. No, man, I took originally it was fuck coming out of 97 into 98 is when I started playing with them, and then March of 99.
So this is post Gigi.
Yeah, Gigi died 93. Mike Denai did, well, Jeff Clayton from Anti-Scene did the rest of the Brutality tour dates, and then Mike Denied came in. They cut the Right to Remain Violent 7-inch, and then the EP Feed My Sleeves, and then Mike. Another dead one, fucking Mike. Terrible fucking drug addict, terrible, terrible junkie, man. I mean, I didn't know him personally, but every time I was around him, he's just fuck. I mean, I was around him a few times, and he's just fucking wasted, fucked up, and in and out of Rikers Island and shit, in New York. And anyway, he Merle couldn't deal with Mike doing the shit. Just he didn't want to be drug driving. I mean. For however much of a pain in the ass it was to tour with Gigi was not like a career junkie. That's why he died. I mean, if Gigi was a regular heroin user, that shot wouldn't have fucking killed him. He didn't use heroin regularly, but he was hanging out with some people who did, and he fixed as they fixed, and they woke up the next day going, "What the fuck? Hey, Gigi, get up! He's dead." So anyway, long story short, Mike was out. They got this guy Francis, who wound up playing guitar with him. Well, I think he's still playing guitar with him part time, at least. He filled in at between Mike and myself. And then again, I started rehearsing with them like going into 98. Played with them all through the rest of 98 into 99. And then March of 99, I wound up having to go to court for some stupid shit in DC, which I don't want to talk about. But, I had faced the music on some bullshit, and that put the kibosh on things temporarily. And then I didn't see Merle or talk to any of those guys until 03. And then they got William Weber, their mainstay guitarist, who was on the Brutality record, back in the band. So it was basically like the quintessential Murder Junkies. It was Merle Allen, Bill Weber, and Dino Sex, and me. 03 to well, and then Weber left in 05, late 04. Early 05, whatever the fuck. And then we got Scotty Wood came in. We did a big national tour, did a tour with Hank 3, went to Europe together. And then I left that second time in 2006 because the
So
way
you guys
Rejectors.
toured with Merle the or with the third what's Hank
Hank 3.
Allen Hank three yeah.
Hank 3. Yeah, we, well, both Murder Junkies and Wayward Drifters. Well, I knew Hank 3 forever. We met in early in 2000, and I'm actually the one who introduced Hank 3 to Merle Allen, man. It's fun. It's small world shit, but yeah, I knew Shelton for a long time, and we wound up, it was one of those things, man. Like, yeah, it's weird because that I learned a lot about, I mean, I'll say this much. You wind up singing for fucking Gigi Allen's old band. At the very least, I'll never be afraid of any crowd you put me in front of. Like, you know what I mean? Like in any fucking band, you know what I mean? Not that I was ever particularly like prone to stage fright, but I mean, man, I've had things thrown at me you wouldn't believe, man. pieces of rock, of fucking, beer bottles, cups full of piss, fucking, shit, a prosthetic leg, some asshole in Copenhagen, Denmark. I looked up. I thought somebody was trying to kick me in the face. I seen the bottom of some dude's boot coming. I duck, and then there's nothing behind it. I turn around, and I see this guy hopping in front of me. This fucking lunatic took his goddamn prosthetic leg off and hurled it at my fucking head. And then I probably gave myself some incurable disease because I grabbed, this is on video actually. I think this is on YouTube unless they pulled it. I fucking grab his leg, man. And I take a pitcher of beer and I pour the remainder of my pitcher of beer into the hollow cavity of this ass, crusty fucking asshole, sweaty fucking prosthetic leg.
That's so gross.
And I grab the mic. I'm like, thanks for the souvenir, Nancy. And I fucking finish my beer out of his fucking leg. I mean, God knows what kind of fucking parasitical fucking, I probably got TB or all kinds of shit, nasty shit.
Yeah.
But the best part is when the show was over, I didn't give the fucking leg back at first. I took it backstage with me. All of a sudden, there's this knock on the door. And the fucking security guy is like, oh, do you mind giving this guy his leg back, please? And I was like, fuck him. So he threw it at me. So I was like, it's mine. I found it. I'm keeping it. And then I look, and the dude's like, I'm looking over the security guy's shoulder, and there's a dude hopping behind him. He's like, can I please have my leg back? I said, give me something for it, man. I said, I'm a capitalist. I said, barter for it. Barter for your fucking leg back. It's my new beer stein. Barter for it. And the guy goes in his pocket and he pulls out a fucking half a Hershey bar sized brick of hash. He's like, will this do? I'm like, fucking A, it will. I took his hash. I gave him the leg back. And here's the best part. I put the hash up, right? I just forget about it. You know when the next time I saw that brick of hash was?
Customs.
No, thank God, no. I was home taking shit out of my pockets to fucking do my laundry. My fucking road bag must have stank so goddamn bad after that fucking tour. If they did see it, they didn't want to go find it. Not in my dirty. And so, yeah, I got all the way home and was like, ooh, I forgot about that. I don't know how I got home. But
So, your bag's probably.
So that's the night that I accidentally smuggled a brick of hash across the Atlantic Ocean by way of trading this guy his hollow fucking leg back for it that I was drinking beer out of. Only in the Murder Junkies, man. There's no other band you can ever fucking talk to somebody from that could tell you that, you know.
Did you ever get to see G.G. Allin perform?
I wish. Well, matter of fact, I'll go back to your question before.
I think I might go back to that one, too.
That'd be my answer, you know.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm tied to him, you know, and I never got to see him. He died right as I was getting into that scene and starting to go up to New York and shit. I mean, he died that summer. That summer I was up there. He died late June. I was there like the week after 4th of July weekend going to shows in New York. I mean, I missed him by a month. He fucking was dead.
Yeah. I was friends when I lived in the Bay Area. I was pretty good friends with Sammy from Fang.
And I've met Sam a few times. Yeah.
Yeah. I know he played with him a bunch of times back in the day, and he told me some good stories.
Well, shit,
about
he played with us when I rejoined the band and we went out there. It was when he was doing Resist the Arrows.
Yeah.
And so it was fuck, man. We played on some great shows out there, man. Us and Sammy and them and Exploited and Total Chaos, and there were some good bills out there.
Yeah, he's a good dude. He lives in Tucson, Arizona now. He I know him from 12 Step stuff. And you know, he's got the G.G. Allin-esque story, maybe even wilder, you know. And
he crossed the line that G.G. wished he could have crossed.
Yeah. If anybody wants to go look into the history of the Bay Area, the old Oakland punk band called Fang, look into that history. And he's a good dude. He's a really nice guy. He's he helps a ton of people in sobriety and.
He and I are connected on like, it was an Instagram or whatever the fuck. And like, that guy's not aging, man. He looks the same as he did 15 years ago.
He probably is getting better because he's sober now, you know?
But well, he was at least in his like pushing around. He was hovering around 40 when I met him. So he's got to be mid 50s at least, right? Somewhere in there.
Yeah. Early 50s. Probably he has an adult daughter and stuff, you know? So,
yeah,
but yeah, great guy. I was never a huge fan of Fang, but like their real early stuff's pretty cool, and they're, you know.
Did you ever hear the fucking Resist the Arrows?
Yeah,
they're fucking great, man. I love playing with them.
Yeah, yeah. Great. I used to be in a motorcycle club in Oakland, and they'd play at our clubhouse a lot of the time, so it was pretty fun. And yeah, he's a nice guy.
Here's how you know I ride. I'm not going to ask what club while we're on camera here.
Not a 1% club, so no
Okay.
worries. Yeah. Yeah, you're still riding motorcycles?
All the time. Yep.
Right on. What do you have? What are you riding?
I've only got one. It's my baby, man. I've got a 15 Heritage Softail Classic with fucking white walls on it. I
Cool.
thought about extending the pipes, but my friend did that, and every Chicano that sees him stops
Yeah.
and offers him money for that bike, man. I was like, I
Like
don't want to be harassed.
low rider style. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. Yeah, the last thing I had, I rode sport bikes and stuff for a long time, and got the last thing I had was a super hot rodded out, clubbed out Dyna. It was pretty badass. I sold it when I moved up here just 'cause I got to Oregon, and I used when I live in California, I ride every day. I had a Harley, I had a BMW, dual like adventure bike. I had a SV650 little street bike, and I could ride every day. But I got up
Yeah.
to Oregon, and it's just kind of like I don't have that many friends up here to ride with anymore, and it rains all the time. So I got rid of everything, and now I definitely don't have time. Sometimes think I want to get a dirt bike again just for around the farm and stuff like that, but.
Sure.
I got real lucky a whole bunch of times, and it's a miracle that I'm not dead. And so, sometimes you gotta hang it up.
I can understand that. I mean, I've definitely cheated death. You get chased across the room by a black mamba once or twice in your life, it'll humble the shit out of you if you're paying attention,
Yeah. Well, I've had you for 1 hour and 20 minutes. Tell us about snake stuff, and then we'll get you out of here.
Oh man, I lucked out. I wound up walking in. I was in Wilmington, North Carolina. I walked into this amazing reptile exhibit called the Cape Fear Serpentarium. The guy that ran it's a legend in that world, Dean Ripa. And we became fast friends. He became my best friend and my mentor for the last 3 years of his life, man. He's the guy that pioneered like breeding Bushmasters in captivity. And I mean, the guy was just, I mean, a complete just boss of a legend, man. He was friends with Hunter, he was friends with the was re really good friends with William S. Burroughs. He palled around with Salvador Dali when he was in Italy, studied fresco oil painting and shit with Pietro Annigone. I mean, the guy just, those Dos Equis commercials, the most interesting man in the world. That motherfucker's got nothing on
Yeah.
Dean, man. That guy was just led a king's life, man. But anyway, he taught me pretty much everything I know in that world. And then I was there when he passed away. He was killed by his wife, went off her fucking meds and shot him dead right in front of their son. And I
Yeah.
was right downstairs when that happened, which was probably the worst day of my life. But anyway, yeah, I spent years in that exhibit, man. You name it, Gaboon vipers, Bushmasters, every type of rattlesnake. I worked with an amazing Malaysian king cobra that was as big as a fucking Cadillac, an 18-foot snake. Bubble Boy, the saltwater crocodile. I mean, you name it, man. It was, but I pursued it with him and then on my own time as well. And it's a similar thing to what I'm getting, working horses these days. It's funny because, like, horses are on the menu for everything because, they're herbivoric prey animals, right? And or herbivorous rather, prey animals. And snakes, minus unless you're a rodent or a fish or whatever, like they're on the menu for everything too. And both of those animals, without meaning to, could kill you or I in a split second merely trying to get away from us,
Yeah.
right? So I have sort of parlayed some of what Dean instilled in me. It's kind of like I worked this rescue horse not long ago, and the guy said something about like, man, you walked in there and your pulse didn't look like it cracked 80. This horse has been scaring every other fucking guy out of the pen. He says, man, you walked in there like you owned the motherfucker. And it wasn't that I was particularly confident or cocky or whatever. I just, and it's not as sure as hell isn't that I knew what the fuck I was doing, because every animal's different. I didn't know this horse. But what I did have was the understanding of like, okay, again, if you've ever had to get out of the way of a pissed off black mamba, you really have no reason to be afraid of a scared horse. Like, not logically, so. But man, you want to open up the Pandora's box on reptiles, you know, you're gonna wind up with a 5-hour episode, and you probably wind up drinking again before I'm done telling you the horror stories. So we could, if you want to ever have me back, man, we could save it for another time though. Be
Yeah,
cool.
I'd love to have you back, man. This has been a lot of fun. Yeah, conspiracies and punk rock's like it's my two favorite things in history too. So,
There you have it,
man,
man. Well, I
you're
appreciate the invite, and I hope to meet your mother-in-law next time, given that she's the matriarch of your show handle and everything, you know.
Dude, she saw Black Flag in the early 80s in San Francisco. On
Wow.
accident, I think.
On
Not that
accident, it's even
you
better.
wouldn't expect her to have been at that show if you look at her. So 70
Fair.
something year old Jewish lady. So JB, tell everybody, is there anything that you want to promote or anything like that?
Just life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, man.
Cool.
Everybody stay well, stay blessed. You can find me. I'm on one Instagram. I don't really get on Facebook often. I do the I do the IG now and again.
What's
I'm
your
on
handle on
Twitter now.
Instagram?
I've got my main page, which is at JB Beverly, and then I've got my kind of where I riff on shit called Salty Old Cowboy. I do I goof on people's like reels and shit and make fun of people. And I
Cool.
kind of it's borderline trollish. It's just me being an asshole, playfully. It's me being an asshole. And then I'm on X under my name. I'm on, yeah, man. I'm not hard to find, but you know, but yeah, I don't want to promote shit, man. Everybody stay well, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I know you mentioned maybe doing a podcast a while back. Any update on that?
I wish, man. I mean, I don't think I'm short on personality or things to talk about. I just, you know, there's two types of people that run a show. You got people like, you know, that can do two, 3 hours by themselves. And you know, for example, people can talk all the shit they want about Rush Limbaugh, but like that guy used to do a 3-hour show with nothing but header notes by his fucking self. Never once had a co-host, never
Yeah,
once had a guest. It's like,
every day.
I can't do that. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe I could. I don't feel comfortable trying, right? But I do my best, like riffing with somebody. I don't have the right co-host. Also, I don't know what the fuck I talk about. They say you've got to have a niche. You know, you look at like, I don't know how, why, obviously you're into conspiracies and historical stuff. You look at like what Scott and William do, you know, it's largely history, current events themed. I don't know what the fuck I want to talk about, man. You know, if I talk about one thing for too long, I get bored. You know, and yet, but yet, if I don't like narrow it down, I can talk about 1,000 things and bore everybody else. So,
Well, I think you could do it. If you ever need any help with it, let me know. We'd love to assist you. But
appreciate
yeah,
you.
this has been a ton of fun, and yeah, we'll talk again soon, hopefully. So yeah, be well. God bless you, man. We really
You,
appreciate it.
brother. I appreciate you, man.
Right on. Have a good night.
All
Thanks,
right.
everybody, for listening. I'll see you soon.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people or those black babies. Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass to lay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order, idiots, playing God all day. Deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that 7-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap. And you're gonna be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.